Yes, very. This fellow Aubrey you nailed, some of his family hired this bird Dawn to defend him. Aubrey wouldn't have anything to do with him when Dawn came to see him. This three-named shyster nearly went over himself last year on a blackmail rap, something to do with a person named Hill, but squirmed out of it. Got some property out on Liebert Street, wherever that is. Want me to keep digging? That'll do. We'll stick around till we hear from Dick. Mickey yawned and said that was all right with him, never being one that had to run around a lot to keep his blood circulating, and asked if I knew we were getting nationally famous. I asked him what he meant by that. I just ran into Tommy Robbins, he said. The Consolidated Press sent him here to cover the doings. He tells me some of the other press associations and a big city paper or two are sending in special correspondents, beginning to play our troubles up. I was making one of my favorite complaints, that newspapers were good for nothing except to hash things up so nobody could unhash them, when I heard a boy chanting my name. For a dime, he told me I was wanted on the phone. Dick Foley. She showed right away. To 310 Green Street, full of coppers, mouthpiece named Dawn killed. Police took her to the hall. She's still there? Yes, in the chief's office. Stick, and get anything you pick up to me quick. I went back to Mickey Linehan and gave him my room key and instructions. Camp in my room. Take anything that comes for me and pass it on. I'll be at the Shannon around the corner, registered as J.W. Clark. Tell Dick and nobody. Mickey asked, "What the hell?" Got no answer and moved his loose-jointed bulk toward the elevators. Chapter 24. Wanted. I went around to the Shannon Hotel, registered my alias, paid my day's rent, and was taken to room 321. An hour passed before the phone rang. Dick Foley said he was coming up to see me. He arrived within minutes. His thin, worried face was not friendly. Neither was his voice. He said, "Warrants out for you. Murder. Two counts. Brand and Dawn. I phoned. Mickey said he'd stick. Told me you were here. Police got him. Grilling him now." "Yeah, I expected that." "So did I," he said sharply. I said, making myself drawl the words, "You think I killed them, don't you, Dick? If you didn't, it's a good time to say so." "Going to put the finger on me?" I asked. He pulled his lips back over his teeth. His face changed from tan to buff. I said, "Go back to Frisco, Dick. I've got enough to do without having to watch you." He put his hat on very carefully and very carefully closed the door behind him when he went out. At 4 o'clock, I had some lunch, cigarettes, and an Evening Herald sent up to me. Dinah Brand's murder and the newer murder of Charles Proctor Dawn divided the front page of the Herald, with Helen Albury connecting them. Helen Albury was, I read, Robert Albury's sister, and she was, in spite of his confession, thoroughly convinced that her brother was not guilty of murder, but the victim of a plot. She had retained Charles Proctor Dawn to defend him. I could guess that the late Charles Proctor had hunted her up and not she him. The brother refused to have Dawn or any other lawyer, but the girl, properly encouraged by Dawn, no doubt, had not given up the fight. Finding a vacant flat across the street of Dinah Brand's house, Helen Albury had rented it and had installed herself therein with a pair of field glasses and one idea, to prove that Dinah and her associates were guilty of Donald Wilson's murder. I, it seems, was one of the associates. The Herald called me a man supposed to be a private detective from San Francisco who has been in the city for several days, apparently on intimate terms with Max, Whisper Thaler, Daniel Rolfe, Oliver Reno Starkey, and Dinah Brand. We were the plotters who had framed Robert Albury. The night that Dinah had been killed, Helen Albury, peeping through her window, had seen things that were, according to the Herald, extremely significant when considered in connection with the subsequent finding of Dinah's dead body. As soon as the girl heard of the murder, she took her important knowledge to Charles Proctor Dawn. He, the police learned from his clerks, immediately sent for me and had been closeted with me that afternoon. He had later told his clerks that I was to return the next, this, morning at 10. This morning I had not appeared to keep my appointment. At 10:25, the janitor of the Rutledge block had found Charles Proctor Dawn's body in a corner behind the staircase, murdered. It was believed that valuable papers had been taken from the dead man's pockets. At the very moment that the janitor was finding the dead lawyer, I, it seems, was in Helen Albury's flat, having forced an entrance and was threatening her. After she succeeded in throwing me out, she hurried to Dawn's offices, arriving while the police were there, telling them her story. Police sent to my hotel had not found me there, but in my room they had found one Michael Linehan, who also represented himself to be a San Francisco private detective. Michael Linehan was still being questioned by the police. Whisper, Reno, Rolfe, and I were being hunted by the police, charged with murder. Important developments were expected. Page 2 held an interesting half-column. Detectives Shep and Vanneman, the discoverers of Dinah Brand's body, had mysteriously vanished. Foul play on the part of us associates was feared. There was nothing in the paper about last night's hijacking, nothing about the raid on Peak Murray's joint. I went out after dark. I wanted to get in touch with Reno. From a drugstore, I phoned Peak Murray's pool room. "Is Peak there?" I asked. "This is Peak," said a voice that didn't sound anything at all like his. "Who's talking?" I said disgustedly. "This is Lillian Gish," hung up the receiver and removed myself from the neighborhood. I gave up the idea of finding Reno and decided to go calling on my client, old Elihu, and try to blackjack him into good behavior with the love letters he had written Dinah Brand, and which I had stolen from Dawn's remains. I walked, keeping to the darker side of the darkest streets. It was a fairly long walk for a man who sneers at exercise. By the time I reached Wilson's block, I was in bad enough humor to be in good shape for the sort of interviews he and I usually had. But I wasn't to see him for a little while yet. I was two pavements from my destination when somebody sssed at me. I probably didn't jump 20 feet. "'S all right," a voice whispered. It was dark there. Peeping out under my bush, I was on my hands and knees in somebody's front yard. I could make out the form of a man crouching close to a hedge on my side of it. My gun was in my hand now. There was no special reason why I shouldn't take his word for it that it was all right. I got up off my knees and went to him. When I got close enough, I recognized him as one of the men who had let me into the Ronnie Street house the day before. I sat on my heels beside him and asked, "Where'll I find Reno? Hank O'Mara said he wanted to see me."
"He does that. Know where Kid McCloud's place is at?"
"No."
"It's on Martin Street, above King, corner of the alley. Ask for the kid. Go back that-a-way 3 blocks and then down. You can't miss it."
I said I'd try not to, and left him crouching behind his hedge, watching my client's place, waiting, I guessed, for a shot at Pete the Finn, Whisper, or any of Reno's other unfriends who might happen to call on old Elihu. Following directions, I came to a soft drink and rummy establishment with red and yellow paint all over it. Inside, I asked for Kid McCloud. I was taken into a back room where a fat man with a dirty collar, a lot of gold teeth, and only one ear admitted he was McCloud. "Reno sent for me," I said. "Where'll I find him?"
"And who does that make you?" he asked.
I told him who I was. He went out without saying anything. I waited 10 minutes. He brought a boy back with him, A kid of 15 or so with a vacant expression on a pimply red face.
Go with Sonny, Kid McCloud told me.
I followed the boy out a side door, down two blocks of back street, across a sandy lot, through a ragged gate, and up to the back door of a frame house. The boy knocked on the door and was asked who he was.
Sonny, with a guy the kid sent, he replied.
The door was opened by long-legged O'Mara. Sonny went away. I went into a kitchen where Reno Starkey and four other men sat around a table that had a lot of beer on it. I noticed that two automatic pistols hung on nails over the top of the door through which I had come. They would be handy if any of the house's occupants opened the door, found an enemy with a gun there, and were told to put up their hands. Reno poured me a glass of beer and led me through the dining room into a front room. A man lay on his belly there, with one eye to the crack between the drawn blind and the bottom of the window, watching the street.
Go back and get yourself some beer, Reno told him.
He got up and went away. We made ourselves comfortable in adjoining chairs.
When I fixed up that Tanner alibi for you, Reno said, I told you I was doing it because I needed all the friends I could get.
You got one.
Cracked the alibi yet? He asked.
Not yet.
It'll hold, he assured me, unless they got too damned much on you. Think they have?
I did think so. I said, no, McGraw's just feeling playful. That'll take care of itself. How's your end holding up?
He emptied his glass, wiped his mouth on the back of a hand, and said, I'll make out. But that's what I wanted to see you about. Here's how she stacks up. Pete's throwed in with McGraw. That lines Coppers and Beer Mob up against me and Whisper. But hell, me and Whisper are busier trying to put the chive in each other than bucking the combine. That's a sour racket. While we're tangling, them bums will eat us up.
I said I had been thinking the same thing. He went on.
Whisper'll listen to you. Find him, will you? Put it to him. Here's the proposish. He means to get me for knocking off Jerry Hooper, and I mean to get him first. Let's forget that for a couple of days. Nobody won't have to trust nobody else. Whisper don't ever show in any of his jobs anyways. He just sends the boys. I'll do the same this time. We'll just put the mobs together to swing the caper. We run them together, rub out the damned fin, and then we'll have plenty of time to go gunning among ourselves. Put it to him cold. I don't want him to get any ideas that I'm dodging a rumpus with him or any other guy. Tell him I say if we put Pete out of the way, we'll have more room to do our own scrapping in. Pete's holed up in Whiskey Town. I ain't got enough men to go down there and pull him out. Neither is Whisper. The two of us together has. Put it to him.
Whisper, I said, is dead.
Reno said, is that so?
As if he thought it wasn't.
Dan Rolfe killed him yesterday morning down in the old Redmond warehouse, stuck him with the ice pick Whisper had used on the girl.
Reno asked,
you know this? You're not just running off at the head.
I know it.
Damned funny none of his mob act like he was gone, he said, but he was beginning to believe me.
They don't know it. He was hiding out with Ted Wright, the only one in on the ware. Ted knew it. He cashed in on it. He told me he got 100 or 150 from you through Peak Murray.
I'd have given the big umpche twice for that straight dope, Reno grumbled.
He rubbed his chin and said, well, that settles the Whisper end. I said, no.
What do you mean, no?
If his mob don't know where he is, I suggested, let's tell them. They blasted him out of the can when Noonan copped him. Think they'd try it again if the news got around that McGraw had picked him up on the quiet?
Keep talking, Reno said.
If his friends try to crack the hoosegow again, thinking he's in it, that'll give the department, including Pete's specials, something to do. While they're doing it, you could try your luck in Whiskey Town.
Maybe, he said slowly. Maybe we'll try just that thing.
It ought to work, I encouraged him, standing up.
I'll see you. Stick around. This is as good a spot as any while there's a reader out for you. And we'll need a good guy like you on the party. I didn't like that so much. I knew enough not to say so. I sat down again. Reno got busy arranging the rumor. The telephone was worked overtime. The kitchen door was worked as hard, letting men in and out. More came in than went out. The house filled with men, smoke, tension. Chapter 25. Whiskey Town. At 1:30, Reno turned from answering a phone call to say, "Let's take a ride." He went upstairs. When he came down, he carried a black valise. Most of the men had gone out the kitchen door by then. Reno gave me the black valise, saying, "Don't wrestle it around too much." It was heavy. The seven of us left in the house, went out the front door, and got into a curtained touring car that O'Mara had just driven up to the curb. Reno sat beside O'Mara. I was squeezed in between men in the back seat, with the valise squeezed between my legs. Another car came out of the first cross street to run ahead of us. A third followed us. Our speed hung around 40, fast enough to get us somewhere, not fast enough to get us a lot of attention. We had nearly finished the trip before we were bothered. The action started in a block of one-story houses of the shack type, down in the southern end of the city. A man put his head out of a door, put his fingers in his mouth, and whistled shrilly. Somebody in the car behind us shot him down. At the next corner, we ran through a volley of pistol bullets. Reno turned around to tell me, "If they pop the bag, we'll all of us hit the moon. Get it open. We gotta work fast when we get there." I had the fasteners unsnapped by the time we came to rest at the curb in front of a dark three-story brick building. Men crawled all over me, opening the valise, helping themselves to the contents. Bombs made of short sections of 2-inch pipe packed in sawdust in the bag. Bullets bit chunks out of the car's curtains. Reno reached back for one of the bombs, hopped out to the sidewalk, paid no attention to a streak of blood that suddenly appeared in the middle of his left cheek, and heaved his piece of stuffed pipe at the brick building's door. A sheet of flame was followed by deafening noise. Hunks of things pelted us while we tried to keep from being knocked over by the concussion. Then there was no door to keep anybody out of the red brick building. A man ran forward, swung his arm, let a pipeful of hell go through the doorway. The shutters came off the downstairs windows, fire and glass flying behind them. The car that had followed us was stationary up the street, trading shots with the neighborhood. The car that had gone ahead of us had turned into a side street. Pistol shots from behind the red brick building, between the explosions of our cargo, told us that our advance car was covering the back door. O'Mara, out in the middle of the street, bent far over, tossed a bomb to the brick building's roof. It didn't explode. O'Mara put one foot high in the air, clawed at his throat, and fell solidly backward. Another of our party went down under the slugs that were cutting at us from a wooden building next to the brick one. Reno cursed stolidly and said, "Burn them out, Fat." Fat spit on a bomb, ran around the back of our car, and swung his arm. We picked ourselves up off the sidewalk, dodged flying things, and saw that the frame house was all out of whack with flames climbing its torn edges. "Any left?" Reno asked as we looked around, enjoying the novelty of not being shot at. "Here's the last one," Fat said, holding out a bomb. Fire was dancing inside the upper windows of the brick house. Reno looked at it, took the bomb from Fat, and said, "Back off. They'll be coming out." We moved away from the front of the house. A voice indoors yelled, "Reno!" Reno slipped into the shadow of our car before he called back.
"Well?" "We're done,"
a heavy voice shouted.
"We're coming out. Don't shoot."
Reno asked, "Who's where?"
"Well?" "This is Pete," the heavy voice said. "There's four left of us."
"You come out first,"
Reno ordered. With your mitts on the top of your head. The others come out one at a time, same way, after you. And half a minute apart is close enough. Come on.
We waited a moment, and then Pete the Finn appeared in the dynamited doorway, his hands holding the top of his bald head. In the glare from the burning next-door house, we could see that his face was cut, his clothes almost all torn off. Stepping over wreckage, the bootlegger came slowly down the steps to the sidewalk. Reno called him a lousy fish-eater and shot him 4 times in face and body. Pete went down. A man behind me laughed. Reno hurled the remaining bomb through the doorway. We scrambled into our car. Reno took the wheel. The engine was dead. Bullets had got to it. Reno worked the horn while the rest of us piled out. The machine that had stopped at the corner came for us. Waiting for it, I looked up and down the street that was bright with the glow of 2 burning buildings. There were a few faces at windows, but whoever besides us was in the street had taken to cover. Not far away, fire bells sounded. The other machine slowed up for us to climb aboard. It was already full. We packed it in layers, with the overflow hanging on the running boards. We bumped over dead Hank O'Mara's legs and headed for home. We covered 1 block of the distance with safety, if not comfort. After that, we had neither. A limousine turned into the street ahead of us, came 1/2 block toward us, put its side to us, and stopped. Out of the side, gunfire. Another car came around the limousine and charged us. Out of it, gunfire. We did our best, but we were too damned amalgamated for good fighting. You can't shoot straight holding a man in your lap, another hanging on your shoulder, while a third does his shooting from an inch behind your ear. Our other car, the one that had been around at the building's rear, came up and gave us a hand. But by then, 2 more had joined the opposition. Apparently, Thaler's mob's attack on the jail was over one way or the other, and Pete's army, sent to help there, had returned in time to spoil our getaway. It was a sweet mess. I leaned over a burning gun and yelled in Reno's ear, "This is the bunk. Let's us extras get out and do our wrangling from the street." He thought that a good idea and gave orders. "Pile out, some of you hombres, and take them from the pavements." I was the first man out, with my eye on a dark alley entrance. Fat followed me to it. In my shelter, I turned on him and growled, "Don't pile up on me. Pick your own hole. There's a cellarway that looks good." He agreeably trotted off toward it and was shot down at his 3rd step. I explored my alley. It was only 20 feet long and ended against a high board fence with a locked gate. A garbage can helped me over the gate into a brick-paved yard. The side fence of that yard let me into another, and from that I got into another, where a fox terrier raised hell at me. I kicked the pooch out of the way, made the opposite fence, untangled myself from a clothesline, crossed 2 more yards, got yelled at from a window, had a bottle thrown at me, and dropped into a cobblestoned back street. The shooting was behind me, but not far enough. I did all I could to remedy that. I must have walked as many streets as I did in my dreams the night Dinah was killed. My watch said it was 3:30 a.m. when I looked at it on Elihu Wilson's front steps. Chapter 26. Blackmail. I had to push my client's doorbell a lot before I got any play on it. Finally, the door was opened by the tall, sunburned chauffeur. He was dressed in undershirt and pants and had a billiard cue in 1 fist. "What do you want?" he demanded, and then, when he got another look at me, "It's you, is it? Well, what do you want?" "I want to see Mr. Wilson." "At 4 in the morning? Go on with you." And he started to close the door. I put a foot against it. He looked from my foot to my face, hefted the billiard cue, and asked, "You after getting your kneecap cracked?" "I'm not playing," I insisted. "I've got to see the old man. Tell him." "I don't have to tell him. He told me no later than this afternoon that if you come around, he didn't want to see you." "Yeah?" I took the 4 love letters out of my pocket, picked out the first and least idiotic of them, held it out to the chauffeur and said, "Give him that and tell him I'm sitting on the steps with the rest of them. Tell him I'll sit here 5 minutes and then carry the rest of them to Tommy Robbins of the Consolidated Press." The chauffeur scowled at the letter, said, "To hell with Tommy Robbins and his blind aunt," took the letter and closed the door. 4 minutes later, he opened the door again and said, "Inside, you." I followed him upstairs to old Elihu's bedroom. My client sat up in bed with his love letter crushed in one round pink fist, its envelope in the other. His short white hair bristled, his round eyes were as much red as blue. The parallel lines of his mouth and chin almost touched. He was in a lovely humor. As soon as he saw me, he shouted, "So after all your brave talking, you had to come back to the old pirate to have your neck saved, did you?" I said I didn't anything of the sort. I said if he was going to talk like a sap, he ought to lower his voice so that people in Los Angeles wouldn't learn what a sap he was. The old boy let his voice out another notch, bellowing, "Because you've stolen a letter or two that don't belong to you. You needn't think you..." I put fingers in my ears. They didn't shut out the noise, but they insulted him into cutting the bellowing short. I took the fingers out and said, "Send the flunky away so we can talk. You won't need him. I'm not going to hurt you." He said, "Get out," to the chauffeur. The chauffeur, looking at me without fondness, left us, closing the door. Old Elihu gave me the rush act, demanding that I surrender the rest of the letters immediately, wanting to know loudly and profanely where I had got them, what I was doing with them, threatening me with this, that, and the other, but mostly just cursing me. I didn't surrender the letters. I said, "I took them from the man you hired to recover them. A tough break for you that he had to kill the girl." Enough red went out of the old man's face to leave it normally pink. He worked his lips over his teeth, screwed up his eyes at me, and said, "Is that the way you're gonna play it?" His voice came comparatively quiet from his chest. He had settled down to fight. I pulled a chair over beside the bed, sat down, put as much amusement as I could in a grin, and said, "That's one way." He watched me, working his lips, saying nothing. I said, "You're the damnedest client I ever had. What do? You hire me to clean town, change your mind, run out on me, work against me until I begin to look like a winner, then get on the fence, and now, when you think I'm licked again, you don't even want to let me in the house. Lucky for me, I happened to run across those letters." He said, "Blackmail." I laughed and said, "Listen who's naming it." "All right, call it that." I tapped the edge of the bed with a forefinger. "I'm not licked, old top. I've won. You came crying to me that some naughty man had taken your little city away from you. Pete the Finn, Lou Yard, Whisper Thaler, and Noonan. Where are they now?" Yard died Tuesday morning, Noonan the same night, Whisper Wednesday morning, and the Finn a little while ago. I'm giving your city back to you whether you want it or not. If that's blackmail, okay. Now, here's what you're going to do. You're going to get hold of your mayor, I suppose the lousy village has got one, and you and he are going to phone the governor. Keep still until I get through. You're going to tell the governor that your city police have got out of hand, what with bootleggers sworn in as officers and so on. You're going to ask him for help. The National Guard would be best. I don't know how various ruckuses around town have come out, but I do know the big boys, the ones you were afraid of, are dead. The ones that had too much on you for you to stand up to them. There are plenty of busy young men working like hell right now trying to get into the dead men's shoes. The more, the better. They'll make it easier for the white-collar soldiers to take hold while everything is disorganized. And none of the substitutes are likely to have enough on you to do much damage.
You're going to have the mayor or the governor, whichever it comes under, suspend the whole Personville Police Department and let the mail-order troops handle things until you can organize another. I'm told that the mayor and the governor are both pieces of your property. They'll do what you tell them, and that's what you're going to tell them. It can be done, and it's got to be done. Then you'll have your city back, all nice and clean and ready to go to the dogs again. If you don't do it, I'm going to turn these love letters of yours over to the newspaper buzzards, and I don't mean your Herald crew, the press associations. I got the letters from Dawn. You'll have a lot of fun proving that you didn't hire him to recover them, and that he didn't kill the girl doing it. But the fun you'll have is nothing to the fun people will have reading these letters. They're hot. I haven't laughed so much over anything since the hogs ate my kid brother. I stopped talking. The old man was shaking, but there was no fear in his shaking. His face was purple again. He opened his mouth and roared, "Publish them and be damned!" I took them out of my pocket, dropped them on his bed, got up from my chair, put on my hat, and said, "I'd give my right leg to be able to believe that the girl was killed by somebody you sent to get the letters. By God, I'd like to top off the job by sending you to the gallows." He didn't touch the letters. He said, "You told me the truth about Thaler and Pete?" "Yeah. But what difference does it make? You'll only be pushed around by somebody else." He threw the bedclothes aside and swung his stocky pajamaed legs and pink feet over the edge of the bed. "Have you got the guts," he barked, "to take the job I offered you once before, chief of police?" "No. I lost my guts out fighting your fights while you were hiding in bed and thinking up new ways of disowning me. Find another wet nurse." He glared at me. Then shrewd wrinkles came around his eyes. He nodded his old head and said, "You're afraid to take the job. So you did kill the girl?" I left him as I had left him the last time, saying, "Go to hell," and walking out. The chauffeur, still toting his billiard cue, still regarding me without fondness, met me on the ground floor and took me to the door, looking as if he hoped I would start something. I didn't. He slammed the door after me. The street was gray with the beginning of daylight. Up the street, a black coupe stood under some trees. I couldn't see if anyone was in it. I played safe by walking in the opposite direction. The coupe moved after me. There's nothing in running down streets with automobiles in pursuit. I stopped, facing this one. It came on. I took my hand away from my side when I saw Mickey Linehan's red face through the windshield. He swung the door open for me to get in. "I thought you might come up here," he said as I sat beside him. "But I was a second or two too late. I saw you go in, but was too far away to catch you." "How'd you make out with the police?" I asked. "Better keep driving while we talk." "I didn't know anything. Couldn't guess anything. Didn't have any idea of what you were working on. Just happened to hit town and meet you." "Old friends, that line. They were still trying when the riot broke. They had me in one of the little offices across from the assembly room. When the circus cut loose, I back-windowed them." "How'd the circus wind up?" I asked. "The coppers shot hell out of them. They got the tip-off half an hour ahead of time and had the whole neighborhood packed with specials. Seems it was a juicy row while it lasted. No duck soup for the coppers at that. Whispers mob, I hear." "Yeah. Reno and Pete the Finn tangled tonight. Hear anything about it?" "Only that they'd had it. Reno killed Pete and ran into an ambush on the getaway. I don't know what happened after that. Seen Dick?" "I went up to his hotel and was told he'd checked out to catch the evening train." "I sent him back home," I explained. "He seemed to think I'd killed Dinah Brand. He was getting on my nerves with it." "Well, you mean, did I kill her?" "I don't know, Mickey. I'm trying to find out.
Want to keep riding with me or want to follow Dick back to the coast? Mickey said. Don't get so cocky over one lousy murder that maybe didn't happen. But what the hell? You know you didn't lift their dough and pretties. Neither did the killer. They were still there after 8 that morning when I left. Dan Rolfe was in and out between then and 9. He wouldn't have taken them. I've got it. The coppers that found the body, Shep and Vanneman, got there at 9:30. Besides the jewelry and money, some letters old Wilson had written the girl must have been taken. I found them later in Dawn's pocket. The two dicks disappeared just about then. See it? When Shep and Vanneman found the girl dead, they looted the joint before they turned in the alarm. Old Wilson, being a millionaire, his letters looked good to them, so they took them along with the other valuables and turned them, the letters, over to the shyster to peddle back to Elihu. But Dawn was killed before he could do anything on that end. I took the letters. Shep and Vanneman, whether they did or didn't know that the letters were not found in the dead man's possession, got cold feet. They were afraid the letters would be traced to them. They had the money and jewelry. They lit out. Sounds fair enough, Mickey agreed. But it don't seem to put any fingers on any murderers. It clears the way some. We'll try to clear it some more. See if you can find Porter Street and an old warehouse called Redman. The way I got it, Rolfe killed Whisper there, walked up to him and stabbed him with the ice pick he had found in the girl. If he did it that way, then Whisper hadn't killed her. Or he would have been expecting something of the sort and wouldn't have let the lunger get that close to him. I'd like to look at their remains and check up. Porter's over beyond King, Mickey said. We'll try the south end first. It's nearer and more likely to have warehouses. Where do you set this Rolfe guy? Out. If he killed Whisper for killing the girl, that marks him off. Besides, she had bruises on her wrist and cheek, and he wasn't strong enough to rough her. My notion is that he left the hospital, spent the night God knows where, showed up at the girl's house after I left that morning, let himself in with his key, found her, decided Whisper had done the trick, took the sticker out of her, and went hunting Whisper. So? Mickey said. Now where do you get the idea that you might be the boy who put it over? Stop it, I said grouchily as we turned into Porter Street. Let's find our warehouse. Chapter 27 Warehouses. We rode down the street, jerking our eyes around, hunting for buildings that looked like deserted warehouses. It was light enough by now to see well. Presently I spotted a big square rusty red building set in the center of a weedy lot. Disuse stuck out all over lot and building. It had the look of a likely candidate. Pull up at the next corner, I said. That looks like the dump. You stick with the heap while I scout it. I walked 2 unnecessary blocks so I could come into the lot behind the building. I crossed the lot carefully, not sneaking, but not making any noise I could avoid. I tried the back door cautiously. It was locked, of course. I moved over to a window, tried to look in. Couldn't because of gloom and dirt. Tried the window and couldn't budge it. I went to the next window with the same luck. I rounded the corner of the building and began working my way along the north side. The first window had me beaten. The second went up slowly with my push and didn't make much noise doing it. Across the inside of the window frame, from top to bottom, boards were nailed. They looked solid and strong from where I stood. I cursed them and remembered hopefully that the window hadn't made much noise when I raised it. I climbed up on the sill, put a hand against the boards, and tried them gently. They gave. I put more weight behind my hand. The boards went away from the left side of the frame, showing me a row of shiny nail points. I pushed them back farther, looked past them, saw nothing but darkness, heard nothing. With my gun in my right fist, I stepped over the sill, down into the building. Another step to the left put me out of the window's gray light. I switched my gun to my left hand and used my right to push the boards back over the window. A full minute of breathless listening got me nothing. Holding my gun arm tight to my side, I began exploring the joint. Nothing but the floor came under my feet as I inch by inched them forward. My groping left hand felt nothing until it touched a rough wall. I seemed to have crossed a room that was empty. I moved along the wall hunting for a door. Half a dozen of my undersized steps brought me to one. I leaned an ear against it and heard no sound. I found the knob, turned it softly, eased the door back. Something swished. I did four things all together. Let go the knob, jumped, pulled trigger, and had my left arm walloped with something hard and heavy as a tombstone. The flare of my gun showed me nothing. It never does, though it's easy to think you've seen things. Not knowing what else to do, I fired again and once more. An old man's voice pleaded,
"Don't do that, partner. You don't have to do that."
I said, "Make a light." A match spluttered on the floor, kindled, and put flickering yellow light on a battered face. It was an old face of the useless, characterless sort that goes well with park benches. He was sitting on the floor, his stringy legs sprawled far apart. He didn't seem hurt anywhere. A table leg lay beside him. "Get up and make a light," I ordered, "and keep matches burning until you've done it." He struck another match, sheltered it carefully with his hands as he got up, crossed the room, and lit a candle on a three-legged table. I followed him, keeping close. My left arm was numb, or I would have taken hold of him for safety. "What are you doing here?" I asked when the candle was burning. I didn't need his answer. One end of the room was filled with wooden cases piled six high, branded Perfection Maple Syrup. While the old man explained that as God was his keeper, he didn't know nothing about it, that all he knew was that a man named Yates had 2 days ago hired him as night watchman, and if anything was wrong, he was as innocent as innocent. I pulled part of the top off one case. The bottles inside had Canadian Club labels that looked as if they had been printed with a rubber stamp. I'd left the cases and, driving the old man in front of me with the candle, searched the building. As I expected, I found nothing to indicate that this was the warehouse Whisper had occupied. By the time we got back to the room that held the liquor, my left arm was strong enough to lift a bottle. I put it in my pocket and gave the old man some advice. "Better clear out. You were hired to take the place of some of the men Pete the Finn turned into special coppers. But Pete's dead now, and his racket has gone bluey." When I climbed out the window, the old man was standing in front of the cases, looking at them with greedy eyes while he counted on his fingers. "Well?" Mickey asked when I returned to him in his coupe. I took out the bottle of anything but Canadian Club, pulled the cork, passed it to him, and then put a shot into my own system. He asked, "Well?" again. I said, "Let's try to find the old Redmond warehouse." He said, "You're gonna ruin yourself sometime telling people too much," and started the car moving. 3 blocks farther up the street, we saw a faded sign, Redmond and Company. The building under the sign was long, low, and narrow, with corrugated iron roof and few windows. "We'll leave the boat around the corner," I said. "And you'll go with me this time. I didn't have a whole lot of fun by myself last trip." When we climbed out of the coupe, an alley ahead promised a path to the warehouse's rear. We took it. A few people were wandering through the streets, but it was still too early for the factories that filled most of this part of town to come to life. At the rear of our building, we found something interesting. The back door was closed. Its edge and the edge of the frame, close to the lock, were scarred. Somebody had worked there with a jimmy. Mickey tried the door. It was unlocked. 6 inches at a time, with pauses between, he pushed it far enough back to let us squeeze in. When we squeezed in, we could hear a voice. We couldn't make out what the voice was saying. All we could hear was the faint rumble of a distant man's voice with a suggestion of quarrelsome in it. Mickey pointed a thumb at the door's scar and whispered, "Not coppers." I took 2 steps inside, keeping my weight on my rubber heels. Mickey followed, breathing down the back of my neck. Ted Wright had told me Whisper's hiding place was in the back, upstairs. The distant rumbling voice could have been coming from there. I twisted my face around to Mickey and said, "Flashlight?" He put it in my left hand. I had my gun in my right. We crept forward. The door, still a foot open, let in enough light to show us the way across this room to a doorless doorway. The other side of the doorway was black. I flicked the light across the blackness, found a door, shut off the light, and went forward. The next squirt of light showed us steps leading up. We went up the steps as if we were afraid they would break under our feet. The rumbling voice had stopped. There was something else in the air. I didn't know what. Maybe a voice not quite loud enough to be heard, if that meant anything. I had counted 9 steps when a voice spoke clearly above us. It said, "Sure, I killed the bitch." A gun said something. The same thing 4 times, roaring like a 16-inch rifle under the iron roof. The first voice said, "All right." By that time, Mickey and I had put the rest of the steps behind us, had shoved a door out of the way, and were trying to pull Reno Starkey's hands away from Whisper's throat. It was a tough job and a useless one. Whisper was dead. Reno recognized me and let his hands go limp. His eyes were as dull, his horse face as wooden, as ever. Mickey carried the dead gambler to the cot that stood in one end of the room, spreading him on it. The room, apparently once an office, had 2 windows. In their light, I could see a body stowed under the cot. Dan Rolfe. A Colt's service automatic lay in the middle of the floor. Reno bent his shoulders, swaying. "Hurt?" I asked. "He put all 4 in me," he said calmly, bending to press both forearms against his lower body. "Get a doc," I told Mickey. "No good," Reno said. "I got no more belly left than Peter Collins." I pulled the folding chair over and sat him down on it so he could lean forward and hold himself together. Mickey ran out and down the stairs. "Did you know he wasn't croaked?" Reno asked. "No, I gave it to you the way I got it from Ted Wright." "Ted left too soon," he said. "I was leery of something like that, and came to make sure. He trapped me pretty, playing dead till I was under the gun." He stared dully at Whisper's corpse. "Game at that, damn him. Dead, but wouldn't lay down. Bandaging hisself, laying here waiting by hisself." He smiled, the only smile I had ever seen him use. "But he's just meat, and not much of it now." His voice was thickening. A little red puddle formed under the edge of his chair. I was afraid to touch him. Only the pressure of his arms and his bent forward position were keeping him from falling apart. He stared at the puddle and asked, "How the hell did you figure you didn't croak her?" "I had to take it out in hoping I hadn't till just now," I said. "I had you pegged for it, but couldn't be sure. I was all hopped up that night and had a lot of dreams with bells ringing and voices calling and a lot of stuff like that. I got an idea maybe it wasn't straight dreaming so much as hophead nightmares stirred up by things that were happening around me. When I woke up, the lights were out. I didn't think I killed her, turned off the light and went back to take hold of the ice pick, but it could have happened other ways. You knew I was there that night. You gave me my alibi without stalling. That got me thinking. Dawn tried blackmailing me after he heard Helen Albury's story. The police, after hearing her story, tied you, Whisper, Rolfe, and me together. I found Dawn dead after seeing O'Mara 1/2 block away. It looked like the shyster had tried blackmailing you. That and the police tying us together started me thinking the police had as much on the rest of you as on me. What they had on me was that Helen Albury had seen me go in or out or both that night. It was a good guess they had the same on the rest of you. There were reasons for counting Whisper and Rolfe out. That left you and me.
but why you killed her's got me puzzled.
I bet you, he said, watching the red puddle grow on the floor. It was her own damn fault. She calls me up, tells me Whisper's coming to see her, and says if I get there first, I can bushwhack him. I'd like that. I go over there, stick around, but he don't show.
He stopped, pretending interest in the shape the red puddle was taking. I knew pain had stopped him, but I knew he would go on talking as soon as he got himself in hand. He meant to die as he had lived, inside the same tough shell. Talking could be torture, but he wouldn't stop on that account, not while anybody was there to see him. He was Reno Starkey, who could take anything the world had without batting an eye, and he would play it out that way to the end.
I got tired of waiting, he went on after a moment. I hit her door and asked how come. She takes me in, telling me there's nobody there. I'm doubtful, but she swears she's alone, and we go back in the kitchen. Knowing her, I'm beginning to think maybe it's me and not Whisper that's being trapped.
Mickey came in, telling us he had phoned for an ambulance. Reno used the interruption to rest his voice and then continued with his story.
Later, I found that Whisper did phone her he was coming and got there before me. You were coked. She was afraid to let him in, so he beat it. She don't tell me that, scared I'll go and leave her. You're hopped and she wants protection against Whisper coming back. I don't know none of that, then. I'm leery that I've walked into something, knowing her. I think I'll take hold of her and slap the truth out of her. I try it, and she grabs the pick and screams. When she squawks, I hear a man's feet hitting the floor. The trap sprung, I think.
He spoke slower, taking more time and pains to turn each word out calmly and deliberately as talking became harder. His voice had become blurred, but if he knew it, he pretended he didn't.
I don't mean to be the only one that's hurt. I twist the pick out of her hand and stick it in her. You gallop out, coked to the edges, charging at the whole world with both eyes shut. She tumbles into you. You go down, roll around till your hand hits the butt of the pick. Holding on to that, you go to sleep, peaceful as she is. I see it then, what I've done. But hell, she's croaked. There's nothing to do about it. I turn off the lights and go home. When you...
A tired-looking ambulance crew, Poisonville gave them plenty of work, brought a litter into the room, ending Reno's tale. I was glad of it. I had all the information I wanted, and sitting there listening to and watching him talk himself to death wasn't pleasant. I took Mickey over to a corner of the room and muttered in his ear, "The job's yours from now on. I'm going to duck. I ought to be in the clear, but I know my Poisonville too well to take any chances. I'll drive your car to some way station where I can catch a train for Ogden. I'll be at the Roosevelt Hotel there, registered as P.F. King. Stay with the job and let me know when it's wise to either take my own name again or a trip to Honduras." I spent most of my week in Ogden trying to fix up my reports so they wouldn't read as if I had broken as many agency rules, state laws, and human bones as I had. Mickey arrived on the sixth night. He told me that Reno was dead, that I was no longer officially a criminal, that most of the First National stick-up loot had been recovered, that McSwain had confessed killing Tim Noonan, and that Personville, under martial law, was developing into a sweet-smelling, thornless bed of roses. Mickey and I went back to San Francisco. I might just as well have saved the labor and sweat I had put into trying to make my reports harmless. They didn't fool the old man. He gave me merry hell. This has been a presentation of AudioGo. Red Harvest, text copyright 1929 by Alfred A. Knopf, Inc., all rights reserved. Text copyright renewed 1956 by Dashiell Hammett, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2011 by AudioGo, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.